You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting on commercial radio stations from L.A. to New York, from coast to coast, on Sirius XM, all across the North American continent, on Pacifica stations across America, Europe, and Africa, on American Forces Radio and every U.S. military base in the world, and simulcast as television on both Dish Network, DirecTV, and cable systems nationwide. And welcome, by the way, to AM 1480, We Act Radio, WPWC, here in Washington, D.C., carrying us live, one of our newest affiliates. Leo Girard is on the air with us. He is the president of the United Steelworkers Union. And President Girard, welcome back.
Thank you. Good to be with you, Tom.
Great to have you here with us. The this piece of legislation that passed out of the House on Friday to reauthorize the FAA, and this is the first time in, what is it, 5 years, 7 years, something like that?
In a long time.
Yeah, it's been a while. I've got the New York Times article around here someplace. Yeah, it passed out of the House 248 to 169, almost all Republicans in favor, almost all Democrats against it. It's the first long-term extension for the FAA since 2007. The shutdown has cost the government $350 million in airline ticket revenue so far. But the biggest part of this is that there's a screw the unions provision in here. And according to the New York Times, 24 Democrats are going to support this in the Senate. What's going on?
Well, look, I think it's a huge betrayal. And what's going on is that, again, the extreme right wing of the Republican Party is attacking the middle class by attacking the labor movement, attacking the ability of folks to be represented. And what they're in fact saying is that they want to go to a system whereby, I'll pick a number so I can make the example, there's 100 employees, and if 75 of them vote, and of that 75, 40 vote for the union, then it's considered that those that didn't vote voted for no union.
But 40 is a majority of 75.
So 40 is the majority of the 75, so we should get a union.
Right.
Under these rules, 40 will not be a majority of all the employees, so you won't get a union. Now imagine if we ran our city councils that way, or if we ran our government that way, if we ran any other democratic institution that way, that you took the people who didn't vote and you gave those as no votes or against the administration or whatever the thing was.
Right.
And this is simply a rolling back of the ability of workers to be represented. And in particular, in airlines, when people are moving around all the time, aren't necessarily in one workplace, they may not even be on the same routes.
Yeah. Now, this piece of legislation that is hitting the Senate today, right now, if 35% of airline workers say, we'd like a union, then it gets put to all of the workers in that particular shop, in that particular employer, to
yes.
vote, and it takes a 50% majority, of the vote.
Yes.
And but 35% is enough to trigger the vote. And
right.
this legislation will raise that threshold up to 50%.
Yeah, and you need a majority to get the vote, but then you don't need a majority of those voting. To win the vote, you need a majority of all employees. So they've made it doubly hard
right.
for people to form a union. And again, if you look at what's going on, Tom, in America relative to what's going on in the rest of the world, the rest of industrialized societies, rest of advanced democracies, this stuff is only going on in America where you're working to make it harder for people to vote. In an election so that you're sort of suppressing votes, you're making it harder for people to be represented so they can get a share of the wealth that they produce, get a say in how their work is going to be done. It's a complete abdication of the ability to sustain and build a middle class, and it's being driven by the extreme right, and it's a huge disappointment. I think it's going to form part of a discussion on some of these senators from the Democratic Party that we hear may vote for this bill.
Well, it seems to me like with the ad, the Super Bowl ad over the weekend that pointed out, this union busting group that's been running ads in the New York Times and whatnot,
yes,
and,
yes.
Funded by the usual suspects and billionaires, saying that, only 10% of people in a union voted for it. Well, the fact of the matter is when my dad first went to work for a tool and die shop back in 1957, there was already a union there. So, you know, he would have been one of those people who didn't vote for the union, but he was real happy to have the benefits. And if they had a recertification vote, you know, I'm sure that, you know, but there was never a recertification vote because everybody was really happy with it. This is just deceptive, you know, on a Super Bowl ad. And so how do you stand up against these billionaires and major multinational business interests who want to bust all the unions in the United States and bring us down to the standard of third world countries in terms of our labor standards so that, you know, maybe they can bring some jobs home?
Look, first of all, it doesn't bring jobs home. If you look at the so-called right to work for less states that already had right to work for less, if you look at the statistics there, they've been there, some of them, since the 40s and 50s. Average wage is lower. Average high school graduation rates are lower. Average pension entitlements are lower. Average health care benefits are lower. Average college graduation rates are lower. All it is a right to work for less and make people's lives that much more difficult.
And average lifespan is lower, too.
Average lifespan is lower. I think when you look, Tom, at what's going on, you look at the kind of anger that was in Ohio on SB 5. If you look at what's gone on in Wisconsin, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if Walker didn't make it to the recall, because look at all the stuff that's going on around him.
But he goes to New York and sits down with a few billionaires and goes back home with $5 million.
Yeah, and I think that the average American is starting to see this. And I think that this coming election cycle is certainly going to have to be brought forward. And let me put things in sort of what I've been talking. I just came upstairs from meeting with about 50 of our workers from the paper sector. If you look at what the right wing from ALEC and the billionaires are doing, ALEC is that state...
the American Legislative Exchange Council, the Koch brothers, let's write legislation for states.
If you look at what's going on, you got systematic voter suppression that is targeting seniors, minorities, and young people. If you look at Citizens United, we're the only society on the planet that has equated wealth with speech, money with speech. The more money you have, the louder your voice. If you look at the attack on public sector bargaining, I don't know a policeman, a nurse, a teacher, a cop that brought the economy to its knees, yet they're being blamed. If you look at the right for work less legislation that will make it harder for workers to have collective bargaining strength. If you look at the changing in the voting rules to make it harder for workers in the airlines and railways to form unions. If you look at the destruction of pensions and health care, retiree health care. I just finished going to a place called Century Aluminum, where the retirees had their health care terminated arbitrarily by the employer because they said they couldn't afford it. There's 400 retirees, but the CEO has walked away with $26 million of walking away money. If he'd have walked away with $20 million, they could have paid the retiree health care for the rest of their lives.
Yeah.
If you look at all those things that are going on, and you end up with the most income inequality that we've had in our adult lifetimes, you and I, how do you get the society back to growing a middle class when this is what you're doing?
I think you awaken the people.
The last thing, Tom, is that manufacturing has gone from 23% down to 9%, and we know that's where real wealth is created.
Yeah, and that's our insane trade policies. Leo Gerard, we have about 15 seconds left. What should our listeners do right now?
I think our listeners have to start to demonstrate their anger and their outrage, getting after their members of the House and Senate, both at the state level and the federal level. And they've got to get ready to participate, educate themselves, inform themselves, and work like hell to win the next election.
There you go. And get involved. Get on the ground. Get involved. Leo Gerard, the United Steelworkers Union, USW.org. Sir, thank you so much for being with us again.
My pleasure.
Today.
Keep up the great work.
Thanks. You too, sir. It's an honor to have you on. We'll be back. Tom Hartman here with you, live from Washington, D.C. And, not only this, I got to tell you what's going on with the banksters after this.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
The banksters are trying to cut a deal here in D.C. today, too. Plus, Occupy Wall Street, D.C. was raided. What's next for them?
The kids are coming from everywhere to occupy the streets, confronting the bankers and brokers who are hiding in their fancy suites. They're staking out a territory for the 99% who've been stabbed in the back by Wall Street and betrayed by the government. The kids made a list of why they're pissed: unemployment, racism, war, corporate control of everything, a system rotten to the core.
Welcome back. Taking back the mainstream media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you. This is what happened this weekend in McPherson Square in Washington, D.C., Occupy D.C. As the Park Police basically dismantled the occupation, I mean, it was a very significant one. One of the people who was there is Jason McGaughey. Am I pronouncing that right, Jason?
McGaughey,
I'm sorry. Jason McGaughey is a tenter over at McPherson Square with Occupy DC. OccupyDC.org is their website. And Jason, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom.
So what happened?
Well, the police, we had lost a court date the day before, a court case asking for the right to have a 24-hour notice before the police came in for a raid. And so given that we lost the court case, we had a feeling that they would be coming in at some point through the night. And they came in around somewhere between like around 4:45 and 5 o'clock and started coming in with kind of slowly coming in with like police and riot gear, putting up barricades, and they were blocking off all the streets around, and they had out the cavalry horse cops as well. In the center of the McPherson Square, there's a statue of General McPherson, and we had put a few days before that, had put a giant tarp over top of it. That we had called the Ten of Dreams, symbolizing the hopes of a generation for a more equal country that is not guided by that is guided by the will of the people instead of the will of their corporate elite. About six people that had barricaded themselves inside and were. Three of them were actually on top of the statue, and there was in the beginning it was actually rather calm. There were negotiations with the police about that we ended up deciding to take down the Ten of Dreams ourselves to that way it would not be destroyed. And the
I understand the Smithsonian wanted it actually.
What
I understand
the head of the park police had actually signed a cardboard declaration saying that they would only be removing the bedding that was in the tent. They would not be removing the tent.
Right.
And then as soon as they started going through the tents, they started clearing out virtually all of the tents.
Was that all the tents that had bedding in them?
A good number of them were in compliance, but they were being removed anyway. And that's when tension started to rise when we were being respectful with the park police and being compliant, and then they started. They blatantly went against what they had just previously agreed to, and actually had signed an agreement towards. And so there were park police all around in riot gear,
right.
And as they're destroying our home, our community, I typically take that point of time to start speaking with the police about kind of what is going on, why we're here, telling them various things to look up on their free time about the increasing corporate control over our government, and then talking about kind of the rising basically the rising trends of kind of light fascism with a corporate control of the government, and it was rather interesting. You could see many of the officers' faces and body language as they were thinking about what was going on and not wanting to be there. But there was one officer that was right in front of me who was kind of like staring right into my eyes and had a rather menacing smile on his face and kept gripping his baton. And very visibly was wishing that he could be hitting me with it.
Yeah.
And as I called him out on it, saying, you know, I'm speaking with you about the state of our government and asking you to look into it. you're wanting to beat me up for? Like, what does that say about you? And it was just, I don't know, it was just a rather kind of awareness of kind of the tensions that were going to be coming
up. So, Jason, what's next for the Occupy DC movement?
Well, I mean, we're not going anywhere.
They've made it fairly clear. I mean, Jason interviewed Jacob rather interviewed a few of them. I've got a clip, but I don't want to take up your time by playing it right now. Where they said, you know, Jacob said, you know, if people sleep during the day without sleeping bags and stay up all night, is that a problem? And the guy did not say no. So, you know, is it possible that this could just become, instead of an occupation, a vigil functionally, although it's still an occupation, but, and people sleep someplace else and they just sit up all night?
Yeah. There are a few churches that are letting people stay in, during the night. And, there was actually an interesting encounter with the park police earlier today where one of them had said that we're not even allowed to lay down in the park anymore.
Right.
So, like, without any kind of bedding, we're not allowed to lay down, period. But I left before things, the tension started to rise yesterday, and, I've spoken with many, many friends who were beaten with the batons, and, a woman was just taken away in an ambulance, just a few minutes ago,
This is continuing to this minute.
What?
This is continuing to this minute?
She left a few minutes ago.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Jason, I'm sorry we're out of time, but thanks for being with us today. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you.
Good talking to you.
No banker, no banker, no banker.
Tom Harbin here with you. Clip number one here, Jacob, and then I'm going to pick up your phone calls. But I just wanted to share this with you. President Obama on the Today Show talking about the Super PAC ads coming. This is the first time I've heard him directly address this in a meaningful and significant way. If you think that, you know, 13,000 negative ads run by Mitt Romney against 200 ads by Newt Gingrich down in Florida, which gave Mitt Romney the win, or Mitt Romney outspending Newt Gingrich in South Carolina 2-1, almost all of it negative ads. And in terms of his super PACs, we have no idea how much Gingrich was outspent. It could have been 5-1, 50-1, who knows. But all negative ads, and not just negative ads, but just character assassination ads. If you think Swift Boat Veterans against John Kerry was bad, was evil, you ain't seen nothing until you see what they unleash, what these PACs, who are unaccountable to anybody, unanswerable to anybody, they hide their sources of money. The people behind them never have to, you know, acknowledge who they are. Wait until the general election and they start going after Obama. Anyhow, here's what President Obama had to say about that.
One of the worries we have, obviously, in the next campaign is that there are so many of these so-called super PACs, these independent expenditures that are going to be out there. There's going to be just a lot of money floating around, and I guarantee you a bunch of that's going to be negative. But it's not going to be enough just to say the other guy's a bum. You've got to explain to the American people what your plan is to make sure that there are good jobs at good wages and that this economy is growing over the long term. And whoever wins that argument, I think, is going to be the next president.
Yeah, we'll see. Kyle, in Magna, Utah. Kyle, welcome to the program.
No, thanks, Tom. Yeah, geez, I've been on hold so long, I got run over by my train of thought here.
You called when Leo Gerard was on.
I did. I've met Leo a couple of times in the pre-merge convention with Pace in Portland, and again in the merging convention in Las Vegas. That was 11 years ago. I'm retired now. I'm a retired steel worker. I came out of the OCAW when I started out. I was a worker organizer for them for a while on a few campaigns, but that's neither here nor there. How do we approach these people? I marched the the Occupy movement down in November, and then I left them there because I was being approached by LaRouche people and Ron Paul people and stuff like that, and I didn't want to, you know, to start it off on a bad foot, and somebody like me that's been in the fight for 40 or 50 years, who's a fourth generation socialist, it's a little hard to know how to approach these people, and they're very naive. I think we could bring them over, you know, if we explained it.
You're talking about the Tea Party folks?
Biggest problem, not the Tea Party folks so much, but I guess these crazy right-wing people who want...
Well, the LaRouches are cult followers. I mean, you're not going to... It's like trying to deprogram a Mooney. You need Ted Patrick. You need a professional for that.
I worry about that about myself, too, because I'm so far left now. I mean, I'm in the last 40 years fighting on the left, and I guess you can understand this. We've been driven so far to the left that, the Democratic Party
don't
represent us anymore.
Well, I would say what has happened is that the Democratic Party has moved so far to the center or to the right, and the Republican Party has moved so far to the right. What you're identifying as if what you're calling the left is strong Social Security, strong Medicare, national health care for all, a minimum wage that people can actually live on, workplace protections, worker protections, non-discrimination policies and employment, those kinds of things, that's not the left. The left is the Communist Party of the United States of America that thinks that every business in the country should be nationalized, owned by the government, and run by the government. That's the left, and they've got maybe 400 members. There is no real left in America. There's the center that Fox News calls the left.
Yeah. Well, that's true. As far as health care goes, you know, I've been a single payer advocate for years now, coming out of OCAW, but personally, I'm so far left that I would like to put the doctors on salary and
But that's not left. I mean, that's David Cameron runs a conservative government in the United Kingdom, and he's got his doctors on salary. They've got a national health care system where the government employs all the doctors. And, he's not proposing to undo that. He considers that part of the conservative. It's just amazing how the language has changed, Kyle, and how successfully, these folks, get out this idea that somehow America is a center-right nation when the vast, any polling you do, you'll show 60, 70, 80, 90% of Americans want a strong social safety net. They want to know that if they become disabled at the age of 25, that they've, that Social Security is there for them. They want to know that when they retire, Social Security is there for them. They want to know that if they get sick, they will be taken care of. It's not going to wipe them out. They're not going to have to sell their home to pay the doctor's bills. They'd like to actually have some equity in their home. They want there to be a job. The idea of the government as the employer of last resort, like Franklin Roosevelt did, like many governments do, most governments around the world, the more developed world, that's not even socialism. It's capitalism with government participation, a very small amount of government participation. It's actually laying the floor for capitalism. It's like saying, okay, we're going to have a football game.
Somewhere between Adams and Keynes.
Yeah, it's like saying we're going to have a football game, but, we're going to make sure that there's good turf, and we're going to make sure that the goalpost, and, we're going to make sure that the lines are painted, and we're going to... Anyhow, I got to move along. Kyle, thank you very much for the call. Good point. I appreciate the call. Let's see here. Bill in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Hey, Bill, what's up?
Hi. How you doing, Tom? I really enjoy your show, and thank you for doing what you do.
Thank you.
I was just curious about what your thoughts were about what the Republican April surprise is going to be this year.
April or October?
April. April. Remember that in the last three or four election cycles, what the Republicans have done is they've generated something in every April, March or April, to generate outrage and fear among their hardcore supporters. If you recall, one election cycles, all of a sudden, inexplicably around the country, there was a big rash of gay people showing up, county clerks showing up, and marrying gay people. Another 4 years later, inexplicably around the country, there were immigrants who were having demonstrations that were being funded by, we didn't know exactly who, but they were all happening all over the country about the same time. And if you look at, don't have to look too far under the surface, and getting past your pigeon conspiracy theory, you don't have to look too far to see that that these were actually situations that the Republicans created to generate fear and loathing in their base and get them out there on some topic or another that would get them voting in November.
Yeah, it may well be. I mean, the Ralph Nader campaign in 2000 was taking money from Republicans in some counties and some parts of some states around the country. So, you know, it's not impossible.
I think what they want to do is to do something, and certainly the gay issue has been a firebrand for them, and a major thing that's generated fear and loathing, especially among their fundies.
Yeah.
And usually it's among the fundies, because those are the ones who are really going to be out there to vote if they're scared enough.
Yeah. I would guess if there's going to be an October surprise that's going to work to the benefit of the Republicans, and not just the Republicans but the neocons, it's probably going to be a U.S. or Israeli or combined strike on Iran. But and I think that'll come later in the election cycle. But I frankly,
how do you think that would help them?
It depends on how Obama handles it, and that's where it gets tricky, you know. But his position up to this point has been, let's negotiate this stuff, let's not start bombing, and of course you got the John Boltons of the world who are, you know, pushing really hard for, no, we need to start bombing right now. And Drudge, you know, I mean, amazing, you know, Drudge, one of the top news sites in the country, tragically, you know, run by, you know, a right wing crazy, a right wing a guy with an agenda, let's say, and he was, last week there was a piece about Iran, you know, coming to get us, and it was a link to WorldNet Daily. I mean, it was sourced to a far right hardcore weird, you know, website that was a birther website up until, and may well still be. And this, you know, and they were going through this whole thing about, well, you know, the Ayatollahs are waiting for the 13th or 14th Mufti, and, you know, they think that he's already alive, you know, and all this, which is maybe some small fringe. It's like, it's as if the Iranians were telling their people that they should be prepared to strike the United States because there are some people in the United States who think that Jesus is coming any day now and the rapture is imminent. And therefore, that's a good reason for a military strike. And you know, I read this, you know, with my mouth open. I was like, you know, this is what is, you know, and it was getting, you know, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of clicks, because it was way up at the top of the Drudge Report. And it's like, this is the stuff. This is the, you know, Louise turned to me when she told me about it. She read this and she said, this says to me that we are going to be involved in a war with Iran, that the right wingers are doing everything they can to gin this thing up, and it's not going to be good. And I think she was right. Bill, thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you. That's a good question. What will the October surprise be? Oh, and I never did get to the banksters, this deal that the banksters are trying to work out. Another deadline today. We'll get that and more of the D.C. crackdown tomorrow, right after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And your calls at 866-987-THOM right after this. Okay, I mentioned the debt deal, this mortgage relief. What has happened is the administration has cut this deal with the banks. Specifically, Bank of America, J.P. Morgan Chase, Wells Fargo, Citigroup, and Ally Financial. And what they're saying, you know, among others, there are other participants, but those are the major ones. And what they're saying is, you give $25 billion to a fund, which will work out to about $2,000 for everybody who got screwed by these banks. $2,000 a family. These are families who've seen the value of their house drop by $20,000, $50,000, $100,000, or lost the entire thing, lost hundreds of thousands of dollars in some cases. You give them $2,000, and we won't send you to jail. and Eric Schneiderman in New York, and Kamala Harris in California, the attorney generals respective of those two states, are saying, wait a minute. And so now the government is tightening it down and saying, okay, well, let's make this so that the states still have the right to investigate past crimes by the banks. And we're going to step up oversight of the financial institutions. And the banks have to distribute, you know, they've got to start getting into the refi business, replacing these exploding mortgages with decent mortgages. And if they push this far enough, if they take this far enough, then Schneiderman and Harris are saying, well, maybe California and New York will go along with this. And, you know, I personally am opposed to that. I think that step one is put banksters in jail, and then step two is to start negotiating with their banks. But, you know, we'll see. We'll see how this plays out. Floyd in Terre Haute, West Virginia. Hey, Floyd, what's up?
Hey, you know, you're talking about the mortgage ripoffs.
Yeah.
Let me tell you a little story. This is true. This is my wife and I worked all our life, become disabled. I did, and then about a year later, she did. We're living on a third, less than a third, actually, of what we were when we was both working 5-6 years ago. Anyhow, my bank that has my home, we've had this home now for over 15 years. I am behind a payment, but in January we paid part of the payment. They said we were behind in December, so it went that way. I received a letter stating that if I didn't pay the whole, I'm down to $20,000 owed on the home. If we didn't pay it all by the end of January, they were repossessing the home. Mm-hmm. Well, I've tried to pay the payment now three times to catch it up and make sure everything's cool. They refuse to take my payment. Actually refuse. The bank that we've dealt with, one of the branches that's the closest one to us, has always, only thing I do is call in, they take my debit card and take the payment out. We've paid $100 extra for like the last year, it seems like, every month to try to get everything staying caught up.
Right.
But anyhow, you know, you talk about crooks, now the home's, you know, paid down to $20,000, 15 years, and, you know, now they want to repossess.
And take the whole thing.
Oh yeah, they want, you know, they want their $20,000 today, you know, well, actually by the 30th of January, or they were repossessing. I've talked to the lady at the bank, you know, and all this stuff, and like I said, you know, they don't want to work on it now. They would rather, you know, try to throw us out of our home, and I'll be honest, they're going to have to get the law to get me out of my home. We've had it this long.
Have you called your member of Congress?
I call my member of Congress and also my senators probably twice a week, and it's, you know.
But I mean, ask for the person in their office, who interacts with constituents. I think it's typically called something like, you know, constituent services, and
right.
You know, who will help you out with things like this,
rather than
just the, you know, hey, I'm taking your political opinion person.
Well, what I'm trying to do also, I've been calling, trying to get them to back Bernie Sanders' amendment, or constitutional amendment.
Yeah.
And also, one of my congressmen has decided to try to get a bill passed in the House to, if it's a federal money like the bridge out in California, that they're not allowed to underestimate the cost and then bill for the overages like China did. You know, they built a new bridge out there. I forget how many millions it was. China, we ended up using China still. They underbid everybody in the United States, and then they had all these overages and paid, you know, almost twice for the steel as what they would if they would have got it here in the U.S.
Yeah.
So he's trying to get that passed. But, you know, I try to stay involved. But, you know, this is just blowing my mind that they won't even let me pay the payment, so it is caught up. And, you know, right now it's 30 days behind. As of today, it's 30 days behind. And that's for January. You know, and this is just how ripped off the people are in this country by all the billionaires and the millionaires and the CEOs, because I'm quite sure that, you know, there's several different banks involved in this corporation. They send you a letter once a year saying, oh, you know, this. You know, if you look at it, there's like 8 different companies under this corporation. How do you know if they got federal money? You know, nobody wants to mention that.
Right.
And I'm sorry, I think if they get federal money, they have no right to foreclose on anyone.
Right. Well, this is why I'm very wary. I'm watching this very closely, this federal agreement with these banks that will make sure that no banksters go to prison. After all these thousands and thousands of robo-signings, every single one of those was an act of fraud for which somebody should go to prison. Not to mention the original sales in many cases, lots and lots of fraud there, not to mention the CDOs, go back to Carl Levin's committee hearing where, you know, he was confronting the guys from, I believe it was Merrill Lynch. Oh, you were selling S-word mortgages and talking about it to each other. I mean, there has been so much crime in the banking industry. And Floyd, you're one of the victims of it. I'm sorry to hear your story. Thanks for calling and sharing it with our listeners. I think that we need to do what Ronald Reagan did. He put 1,000 bankers in jail.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Bill Press, who is one of the smartest guys I know, a friend, a colleague. The Bill Press Show runs in the morning, 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern Time. His website, BillPressShow.com. I thought it was just BillPress.com, Bill.
BillPressShow.com. Hey, Tom, how are you?
Great to have you with us. BillPressShow.com. Okay. And you've got a brand new book out, The Obama Hate Machine, The Lies, Distortions, and Personal Attacks on the President and Who is Behind Them. This is fascinating stuff, Bill. Let's start with the lies and distortions. What are they?
Well, first of all, Tom, I just want you to know, I'm still trying, and I will always be trying to catch up with you in terms of writing books.
let's not make it a competition.
You're what, 19 now?
23.
Oh, get out. All right. Okay. Well, I better start writing faster than that. No. Look, the Obama hate machine is real, right? And it's led by the Koch brothers. I think, and I went through, as you and I always do in researching for a book like this, our history in terms of criticism of presidents goes with the territory. I mean, you expect it, and God bless America, we're all free to do it. But the kind of attacks that have been leveled against President Obama from the time he was a candidate for U.S. Senate, from the time he was a candidate for president, and as president, I think are the most personal, negative, ugly, attacks that any president has had to withstand since Abraham Lincoln. And we think of Abraham Lincoln, you know, as Saint Abraham, but during his lifetime, he had some pretty ugly attacks leveled against
him.
Well,
he was vilified to the point that he was assassinated. God forbid. I'm reluctant to even bring up the word, but
right. But they, you know, and they talked about his physical appearance, you know, his wife, his kid. I mean, it was ugly, ugly stuff. And I think if we haven't seen that till we've seen Obama, where he's been called, we've all talked about this, right? It's not just that you disagree with his policies, these people do, but he's been called a communist, a fascist, a Nazi, a terrorist, a jerk, by Rush Limbaugh, famously, right? And other words we can't repeat. And it's all part of an organized campaign to take him down.
Well, I was a couple of years ago, you know, Obama was president, I think it was about 2 years into his presidency. I was in a gun shop in Michigan trying to buy some 40 caliber ammunition for my brother and I to do some competitive shooting. He's got a little shooting range out in his backyard. He lives way out in the middle of nowhere, and he and his wife are really into competitive shooting. They don't hunt, but they, you know, it's like, you know, fun.
Yeah.
And the guy would only sell me 2 boxes of ammunition. And I said, why? And he said, because that, and throws the N-word out, president is trying to take away our guns and people are stocking up. And I'd been in that gun shop a lot of times over the years, and because often I go back to Michigan and my brothers and I go out shooting. And usually the walls were full of ammunition, and he was almost empty. I mean, this guy was wiped out. There was a Michigan-wide, you know, you couldn't buy any caliber ammunition. I mean, you know, Steve has a 38 and a 40 and a 45 and a 22 and what all. I mean, we couldn't get anything.
That's scary.
And they were rationing it. And the reason why was because of these viral emails that had just gone nuts across the Midwest. And I'm assuming that they're all over the country. About how Obama was going to come and take your guns, how they were going to start putting registration numbers on all the bullets so they can track everything back to you.
Yeah, again, the lies. You know, he's done, frankly, he's done nothing except give a speech in Tucson. He's done nothing about gun control.
I know. He's been far less active than George Bush was.
Absolutely. You know, and look, on the business side, and that's where the Koch brothers are going after him mainly, I mean, things have never been better for these corporate fat cats. Corporate profits are higher than they ever. The Dow 3-year record on Friday. You know, the job numbers are going down, and things are booming, and yet they're claiming that he wants to destroy the economy and bring America down. And that's the whole gist, of course, the Romney campaign, but also the Koch brothers. So last weekend, Tom, right, 2 days before my book came out Tuesday, 31st, 2 days before, the Koch brothers had yet another one of their biannual summits in Palm Springs, California. This one didn't get much attention. And with their corporate fat cats, they raised $100 million for this 2012 campaign.
All right, Dave and Charles, I think, committed $30 million of their own to that. Yeah, Lee Fong, we had Lee Fong on the show. He crashed the party there.
I know he did. He is great.
He's the one guy who got in.
Yeah,
he's spectacular. And we're talking with Bill Press, his new book, The Obama Hate Machine, The Lies, Distortions, and Personal Attacks on the President and Who is Behind Them. I was saying in the first hour of this program, given Citizens United and given what we saw in South Carolina and Florida in just the Romney-Gingrich debate, and this is two guys in the same party, the vitriol and the personal animus in these ads and you know, run by these third-party groups, that I think that the swift voting of John Kerry is, we're going to look back on that after the 2012 election and say, oh, that was easy. That was nothing.
That's right. No, mild, right? Mild compared to the way these two guys you mentioned, Gingrich and Romney, have gone after each other. But just imagine what they have in store for Obama.
So what do you think are the main hits against Obama that they're, I mean, the conventional wisdom is going to go against his strength. That's why they went against Kerry's war record. He was a decorated war hero, so they had to turn him into the opposite of that.
Yeah,
What will it be with Obama?
You know, I think they'll.
It so far?
You know, it's a great insight that they do go against their strength. In other words, what appeals to people about Obama is what they'll try to destroy, right? And I think two things. One that immediately come to mind. One is he is a person who tries to work with the other side and takes his time and tries to achieve compromise and get things done that way. As we have talked many times on your show and mine, right, which drives liberals like us crazy.
We should do a little less of that and a little more kicking of ass. But
exactly.
That's, you know, but
right.
Still.
But they will. So they will accuse him of being somebody who is totally, which is just the opposite of what the reality is, right?
Right.
Somebody who is unwilling to reach out, who is unwilling to work with anybody, who is a partisan, liberal, obstructionist, Democrat, right, who doesn't give a damn about the majority of the American people. He's just with the left wing, the Michael Moores and the Tom Hartmans and the Bill Presses of this world. And then I think the other thing is, as we still have a long way to go, but he has done a remarkable job, I think, in bringing this economy back, and the numbers show it. And they will still, no matter, unemployment could get down to 5%, and they'll still say he's the guy that destroyed jobs, destroyed the economy, and took us, you know, down the toilet, when in fact it was George Bush who did it, and he's the one who's bringing us back.
Yeah, well, this is, you know, Mitt Romney, clip number 4, Jacob, if you can quickly pull this out. This is very short. Here you go.
He's been trying to take a bow for 8.3% unemployment. Not so fast, Mr. President. We welcome any good news on the jobs front. But it is thanks to the innovation of the American people in the private sector and not to you, Mr. President.
So there you go, Bill. It's like, you know, if the economy gets better, Romney's going to say, hey, it was my rich buddies who did it. And if the economy gets worse, he's going to say, hey, it was Obama who did it. What do you do?
No. It's just amazing. You know why Romney is saying that, of course? It's because the entire premise of his campaign, right, is washing away. It's slowly being eroded. Because every day as the economy gets better, the case for a guy like Romney, the fixer, right, disappears.
Right.
And he sees that happening.
So the Republicans are going to have to really hurry up and try to crash the economy between now and November, totally obstruct anything that might help rebuild the economy.
And you know they will. Yes, I was going to say, if you look at how much lower the unemployment rate would be if they had passed the public sector jobs bill, which the Republicans killed, if they had passed the construction workers' infrastructure bill, which they killed, if they would pass the payroll tax cut, which they only did for 2 months, right, we'd be in a hell of a lot better shape. They're going to be obstructionist all the way through November.
Yeah, I'm absolutely with you. Bill Press, BillPressShow.com, the new book, The Obama Hate Machine, The Lies, Distortions, and Personal Attacks on the President and Who Is Behind Them, must reading. Get your copy now. Bill, thanks so much for being with us.
Hey, Tom, you're great. Thanks so much. See ya.
Great to see you. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So what do you think is going to be the attack on Obama? This is a very interesting one. And how should he answer it? Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Just wanted to check the New York Times and see if the debt relief. Yeah, deal is closer for U.S. plan on mortgage relief. We're all going to get $2,000. Anybody got screwed in a mortgage. I'm not one of them, but many of you are most likely. And the banksters just get not to go to jail. Maybe. We'll see. We'll see how this all plays out. But you might want to be calling your senator right now and saying, you know, unless this thing provides for banksters to go to prison, please oppose it. Woody in Litchfield Park, Arizona. Hey, Woody, what's on your mind? Thanks for listening to KPHK.
Well, thanks for having me on again.
A
couple of things. When I was at the Occupy Phoenix thing, I had a sign that talked about robo-signing as fraud. There's no doubt about it. Yeah. And I don't know why they can't use those that were, you know, fraudulently signing to turn them against the banksters and prosecute them under RICO.
They could. I mean, I'm not sure that they could do it under RICO, but there's certainly other laws under which they could prosecute them, and that's one of the things that Eric Schneiderman and Kamala Harris in New York and California, respectively, are looking into doing prosecutions of and based on. And it's one of the reasons that they're worried about this national Clemency Act, or whatever you want to call it, you know, where the banksters basically get to buy their way out of this with $25 billion, which is, you know, these same banksters who we gave $700 billion to and the Fed gave, you know, $10, $12, $13 trillion to, they get to take a week's pay and get out of jail free card. And, you know, I just don't think it's right.
I agree. The one thing that I've been on your show for before about is the idea that let the borrowers buy their own mortgage bank, however it was discounted. Lehman Brothers sold theirs for 22 cents on the dollar, or some of theirs. New Century, number two, sold theirs for 35 cents on the dollar.
Right, so if that's your mortgage, you should be able to buy it for that.
Yeah, and the reason I want to tie it back to Schneiderman is I'm a former loan officer with the then Farmers Home Administration. I'm now a real estate appraiser. But when we sold our loans for 50 cents on the dollar, that's what gave me this idea. We allowed the community facility loans to just pay us that same 50 cents, and we called it even. The other part is, unfortunately, the agency lost a promissory note along the way, but we had the financial accounting, and I just signed an affidavit because the mortgage in Colorado as a deed of trust is recorded in the courthouse. And that's how they still have the strength to foreclose, but they have to have a true financial accounting. Getting back to Mr. Schneiderman, have them follow that actual promissory note and who sold it to whom for how much.
Well, that's why he's going after MERS, this automated system that the banks themselves set up to get around having to file with county clerks and all that kind of thing. And basically turning it all into, you know, like online banking. You know, you just do things instantly. And
if he can follow that trail, whoever sold it, and it wouldn't surprise me, it was first sold for probably 95 cents on the dollar, something like that. Yeah. And as it continued to shrink, follow it all the way down to the last amount that it was sold for, and then offer that back to the homeowner.
Right. I am totally with you, Woody. So if somebody's got a $100,000 mortgage and it got sold ultimately to some bankster for $25,000, that person should be able to buy their house for $25,000 back from that bankster. Excellent point. Woody, thank you. Michelle in Los Angeles listening to K-Talk. Hey, Michelle, what's up?
Hi, Woody is absolutely right. Two things. One, the smoking gun for the banksters is that the notes were not in put to the trust. That is a fraud that Wall Street was participating in. They sold the security based on that they would make sure that the notes went to the trust. So if the notes aren't in the trust, that's a very basic fundamental fraud.
What is
the
trust?
The way that it went, it's like a check. A mortgage note is like a check. In order for the trust to foreclose on it now, it has to be doorsed over. So it has to go from your bank where you got the loan to Wall Street. It has to be endorsed.
Right.
Wall Street has to endorse it over to the trust. And that's how it gets to the trust.
But isn't that where the robo-signers came in? Didn't they robo-sign all those things to do
that?
That's
the second fraud. The first fraud was that it didn't get into the trust. The way that you prosecute it is you just pull up the securities and say, "Here, Wall Street, just show us these notes.
Right.
Show us the notes, okay?" There. And they're not going to be able to. That's a very easy way to, or a very simple way for people to understand.
Right.
This is
why Eric Schneiderman in New York, which is where most of these banks are headquartered or located, and Kamala Harris in California, where most of the frauds at the retail level were committed, or very many of them, but I mean most simply because it's the most populous state in the nation, are in very, very strong positions to bring the banksters to their knees and throw a whole bunch of them in jail. And it's why they've been very reluctant to go along with this national settlement, which will help out states like, you know, Wyoming or even medium-sized states like Michigan or Minnesota, who don't have necessarily the resources or the ability. They don't even have the standing to go after banks in New York or loan companies that were in California. But they've got a bunch of people who are screwed. So you've got a bunch of states where, you know, hey, we'll take something. It's better than nothing, even if it's only $2,000 a person. And then you've got, you know, these big states, California and New York, where they're saying, no, we can nail these guys to the wall. I can understand both sides of that argument. I'm frankly in the nail them to the wall side of that argument, but.
Well,
anyway.
The second thing that they can get them on is every time that these banks turn in a financial statement that's based on a fraud, that's a new act of fraud.
Right.
So they keep turning out these new. So the statute of limitations.
So you mean every time they report to their stockholders?
Exactly. Because those statements,
which is monthly,
are supposed to be true.
Right.
I think it's. I'm not sure if it's monthly. I know that they have to file at least quarterly and then annual statements.
Okay. And not only that, under Sarbanes-Oxley, the CEO is personally liable, so the CEO can go to prison. And the CEOs, of course, are large donors to presidential campaigns and congressional campaigns and senatorial campaigns. And might that have something to do with this deal? Might that be why you've got, you know, 22 Democrats supporting this in the Senate? I don't know.
That's, again, these guys can be nailed to the wall in a variety of different ways.
Yes.
And that's why we have to continue to put pressure on our folks on Schneiderman and Kamala not let them.
Well, they're putting a lot of pressure themselves.
Actionable.
We need to put pressure on our senators. Call your senator right now. Michelle, thank you very much.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And the October surprise, what's it going to be? It's an interesting speculation. No, I don't think it'll have anything to do with pigeons. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Our own Jacob Dean was interviewing some park police over the weekend. This is, let's just take clip 11 first, Jacob.
Can you just give me a brief review of what's going on today?
We're continuing our enforcement activities, which we started yesterday up at McPherson Square. And our enforcement activities continue down here at Freedom Plaza, enforcing the Park Service camping regulations. And so it's really no different than what happened yesterday, just an extension of those activities.
That was Officer David Schlosser of the Park Police being interviewed by Jacob Dean, our producer here. And this was, I thought, an interesting response. Notice he doesn't say no. Number 12.
We're allowed to be here for 24 hours. You just can't sleep overnight. Can folks sleep during the day and stay up at night?
Well, it's the camping regulations that we're enforcing here. And the camping regulations are very specific about the collection of bedding materials and that type of thing. And so that's what we're enforcing in the camping regulations.
So my guess is that now, you know, we actually talked with one of the tenors there. And he said that basically if you lay down, they come for you. So what's going to probably happen is off-site people will sleep, whether it's during the day or at night, and then when they're awake, they'll go to the site. And what was an occupation will become basically a vigil, and although you can still call it an occupation. The thing that concerns me, Chris Hedges has an interesting piece today. I'm not sure where he originally published it. I saw it over at Democratic Underground, about the cancer within the Occupy movement, and that would be the guys who dress all in black and call themselves anarchists and go out and smash windows. I haven't seen any evidence of them here in D.C., but they're a little more prominent in Oakland, California. And that mentality that somehow the way to get things done is to smash windows, is to create chaos, is to create violence, is to bring down the system, and then somehow we're going to reboot it. That was the mentality that drove the French Revolution. And if you're not familiar with the history of the French Revolution, I strongly suggest that you spend some time reading up on it. And because they literally reinvented society, they rebooted it, they changed the names of the days, they reset the year to zero. I mean, it was a complete reboot, and it was a disaster. And the whole idea of if you don't give us justice, we won't give you peace, concerns me. Now, if no peace means we're not going away, we're going to sit here and talk, I'm all in favor of that. If no peace means look out for acts of vandalism, I'm really concerned, and concerned, frankly, for the future of the Occupy movement. Because this is the kind of thing, you know, I watched this with SDS. The Weather Underground brought down the SDS. When they started blowing up buildings and killing people, SDS became so discredited that pretty much everybody just said, okay, that's it, we're out of here. And I was there. And I don't want to see that happen with the Occupy movement. But Clip 9, this is one of the chants here in D.C. And again, I don't think that this was a statement of we are preparing to be violent. But I would counsel people to be careful what you chant.
No justice, no peace. No justice, no peace. No justice, no peace. No justice, no peace.
How about no justice, we're not leaving, or, you know, something else. But, I remember that as, well, anyway, enough of that. So we'll see where it goes. We'll see where it goes. And I wish them the very best, and I think that we should all, I mean, show up. Show up at the local Occupy movement. Participate. Let's make this as broad-based as possible, as many people as possible, and as smart as possible in how they move forward. Christine in Shawnee, Kansas. Hey, Christine, back to the foreclosure thing?
You betcha. We've been fighting two different foreclosures in two different states for approximately 4 years now.
We being you and your family?
Just me and my spouse.
Okay.
And we own two homes. They're both either our home or an investment home that we rent out.
Right.
I'm here in Shawnee right now, and this is our rental property. The details of this are we've hired three different lawyers over the course of this time period of 4 years and fired two of them specifically here in the Kansas City area because the legal system here in many ways just seems to be willful idiots for the banks. They, you go into an attorney's office and basically they immediately will steer you towards foreclosure and possibly bankruptcy.
Well, a lot of these attorneys get a lot of their business from the banks.
Exactly, my point. And they never, even though they claim to act as an advocate for the consumer, never, ever go to the consumer side. Right. It's like, well, the Midwest tends to be the land of the deluded about, you know, voting against their own best interests. The legal system here, especially attorneys claiming to be advocates for the consumer, don't go that direction at all. They go exactly the opposite. Right.
So you said your third lawyer you haven't fired yet. What's that lawyer doing different from the other two, or is it you just haven't fired him or her yet?
He's actually truly a consumer advocate. His I can give you his name if you'd like, but I don't want to
probably not a good idea right now. Yeah.
That attorney is helping us with our home in California, in San Jose specifically.
Yeah.
The big difference between Kansas and California, Kansas is a judiciary state. California is a non-judiciary state. So the way you handle things in the legal system are very different. But we went ahead and chose to self-represent here in Kansas, and we just got a dismissal from the court just in the last couple of weeks.
Wow.
That gives us a modification on our mortgage here that dropped our rates 36% every month. We got to keep our house, even though both of us have gone through long-term unemployment. I'm still unemployed. So if you don't fight for this, you will not qualify. I guarantee you that you will not either qualify under the very narrow parameters the Obama administration has set up, or the banks will completely deny you, like the caller earlier who was disabled, both he and his wife, and they were trying to pay current on their mortgage.
Yeah.
He will never get any justice unless he fights this tooth and nail and stands up in court.
Yep.
That's
absolutely
what
right. And the reason why is because during the Bush administration, they passed rules on what a bank could and couldn't write off. And the bank can take money from the government in for their loss. They can then deduct for their loss. And then they get the value of the property, you know, whatever residual value there is. And the accumulation of those three is greater than the cost of the property that you're trying to refinance. And so the bank makes a profit by evicting people and foreclosing on them. And
exactly.
And so what you have to do is interrupt that process with basically a threat of fraud. And in my opinion.
Yeah, they don't keep their end of the contract, so why should we have to honor their contract?
Yeah, there you go.
And, you know, we've been through the ringer on this. We've had the hired thugs try to vandalize the houses and threaten to come lock us out and harass my elderly neighbors and, even break out a window in the house.
Amazing.
And,
amazing.
Just all sorts of very nasty types of things, and then a lot of people, you know, with this delusion of what things should be and that you should be a good person and pay your bills and all this kind of thing. Yeah. And we've been called every nasty thing in the book.
Yeah.
But the matter is that you have got to stand up for your rights and you've got to be brave about it. And it takes a lot of endurance.
Yep.
We just got 4 years on this one house.
Okay.
We're still fighting in
Christina,
California.
Christina, I want to move to some other calls, but thank you. Excellent story, and I really appreciate your calling and sharing it with us. Thanks so much. Susan in Kingsport, Tennessee. Susan, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I was just calling about the right to work thing.
Mm-hmm.
I've always lived in Tennessee, and you have no right to work in Tennessee. They will tell you all the time. They can fire you for any reason. They don't have to have a reason. There's,
right.
You know, you would have a sense of fairness that maybe you would get fired for doing something wrong. They don't have to have that reason. They
That's
can
right.
fire you because they don't like your ex-wife or your ex-husband or your hair color.
Right. It's a right to work for less state. And for that
right.
matter, they can fire you for things that it might be illegal to fire you for, like the color of your skin, as long as they've found some excuse that's not that. And,
right.
And it's
you're always afraid, and it's what we call it job scared, that you're going to get fired at any time, so you have to cave and do whatever they tell you to do.
Yeah, and absolutely right. And so is there any movement in Tennessee to roll back the right to work for less provisions and become a free bargaining state?
No, there isn't.
There
isn't.
People don't get it.
It's been here so long that they don't get it, and now they don't know any other way. They just don't.
Yeah, it's like, you know, circus elephants when they're little. They put a big chain on them and stick them to a big stake and they learn very, you know, over the course of the first year of their life that it hurts them. You know, the thing around their leg has little points in it that it hurts them if they pull hard against that chain, and within a year or so they stop. And then after that they can put, you know, just a small chain on them, and they just, you know, they could easily pull the stake out of the ground, but they just never do because they've been conditioned. And it's the same thing with people who've lived their entire lives or multiple generations in right to work for less states, is they just can't imagine it being any other way. Susan, thank you for the call. Thank you very much. 45 minutes past.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We're going to pick up a few more of your calls and check in with the Talk Radio News Service right after this. 45 minutes past the hour. Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service is going to be with us in just a second, but first I wanted to take just a couple of quick calls on the topic that we've been talking about a little earlier. So let me get into that. If you can be real short, please. Keith in Taos, New Mexico. Hey, Keith. Whoop, got to push the button.
Yeah,
Keith, you're on the air.
There you go. Thanks. Yeah, thanks so much, Tom. That's great. I happened to witness at the Democratic Convention in Denver that the entire black bloc got out of several police vehicles and came up and stood next to my table for a while. They had two guys, each with a bag of rocks in a little book bags you might get at Walmart or something if that's where you went. Mm-hmm. And they six of them went one end of the march, six went to the other, and they started throwing rocks at the police, and they broke out a bunch of windows. That gave the authorities the legal right to arrest like over 100 people.
So you're saying the black bloc folks are police infiltrators, or at least
often
in your experience,
they are.
What you saw. Okay.
Yeah, often they
okay.
are,
Keith,
and I often am trying to keep the young people from joining them.
Yeah, and I, you know, okay, Keith, thank you very much for that call. John in Santa Cruz, California. John, you wanted to comment on this.
Right.
You're an
I'm
Occupy
not
Oakland
a young
member.
Person. And I'm not a young person. I'm a former punk rocker from that era, and I'm an Occupy marcher, and it's my philosophy that it's not violent unless someone gets hurt.
Right.
And the government.
So you think that you think that damaging property is not violence?
It depends on the property. If the property is in the process of damaging the public, then breaking a few windows is just making a statement.
Yeah, I would submit to you, John, that if you're breaking a few windows, the statement that you're making is that you're destroying the movement around you.
I'm sorry.
You are absolutely playing into the hands of the police, and you are absolutely playing into the hands of the system. You are their best front man if you're smashing windows at the Bank of America or whatever, no matter how much
right,
you may hate the Bank of America.
I feel the government speaks in two languages right now, violence and money. And unless you can speak in one of their languages, they're not going to listen.
There's a third language, and it's called nonviolence. And if you use nonviolence, it is more potent than money, and it's more potent than violence. And we've seen that. We saw that in the abolition movement. We saw that in the suffrage movement. We saw that in the civil rights movement. We've seen
that. But who is Dr. King without Malcolm X?
I think without Malcolm X, Dr. King would have been just fine, thank you very much. And Malcolm X, by the way, wasn't out there smashing windows. He was using pretty strong rhetoric, but he was not smashing windows. The groups that were smashing windows in the civil rights movement were very, very quickly marginalized, and everybody in the civil rights movement moved as fast and as far away from those folks as they could.
I'd love to agree with you, Tom, and I marched under that pretense for a long time, and I lost my home. My wife left me because of it, and, you know, I became under a different perspective.
This is where your true... The true integrity of your soul, of your nature, of your conviction is going to be tested, John, Because if you can be nonviolent in the face of violence, and if you can be poor in the face of riches, and maintain your integrity and not play their game, because you will always lose when you play their game. Their game is violence. You play that game, you're going to lose. They got tanks, they got helicopters, they got guns, they got jails. You play that game, you'll lose. And not only will you lose, but you'll tarnish everybody else who's trying to play the game of nonviolence. Nonviolence is the most powerful force on earth. The love is 100 times more powerful than hate. And you know, respectfully, you need to find that place inside yourself where you can, as Ram Dass once said 20 years ago, he said, even the most, you know, vile, racist, billy club wielding, you know, African-American smashing, white southern racist sheriff deep down inside just wants to be loved. You've got to find that place in yourself where you can see the fundamental humanity in even the people who are committing evil acts. You oppose their evil, but you don't do it with evil, you know, respectfully. But, John, I wish you the very best, and thank you for calling and sharing your honest opinions with us. Is that okay?
Yeah, great.
Okay. Thank you, John. Thank you very much. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service. Victoria, what's going on in the world?
Well, and it is the world that we're going to talk about. Susan Rice, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations today, urged Egypt to immediately release the 19 Americans, including the son of Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood, who are being held and facing trial under criminal charges of stirring up anti-government arrest in Egypt. She says these Americans have done absolutely nothing wrong. They do what American and international NGO workers do in various different parts of the world, which is to support democratic development and civil society.
Right.
Absolutely no sign that Egypt plans to release them at all.
Very, very interesting. This is the backlash to the Arab Spring.
Yes, indeed. You've got prosecutors being used apparently complicitly by a military junta. And it's interesting that you have NGO workers being prosecuted by the regime, but you haven't seen anybody prosecuted by the regime for shooting or killing protesters.
Yeah, there's this thing called the J-curve that was proposed some decades ago by a political philosopher who suggested that when a country undergoes such a radical destabilizing event, that its form of government changes, that there is a collapse period, a downward slope in the J, and if they get their bearings, then slowly they will come back up and they will all ultimately become stable again and ideally become a democracy. They may end up stable as an autocracy again, but they'll regain stability. Egypt, I think, is at the bottom of that trough right now.
Yes.
And we really need to help them through that, or this is and it's not just Egypt. Same thing with Libya. Same thing is going on in Syria. Or it's, you know, we're on the edge of it.
You have to say to people, remember what happened in France after the revolution. They didn't all suddenly start drinking wine and eating cheese.
I keep saying to people, if you think you can just reboot the system, please study the French Revolution and learn the story of Maximilian Robespierre.
Yes.
Anyway, back to you. We got a minute.
Yes, very quickly. President Obama ordered new sanctions today on Iran's government, including the central bank, saying that basically they've got deceptive practices and they've been trying to get around sanctions. So he's toughened those sanctions. Also today, we closed our embassy in Syria and pulled out all staff because they have not been responsive, the State Department says, to security concerns.
Very interesting. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And on the line with us is Daniel Flynn, Flynn, F-L-Y-N-N, files.com. His website, his new book, Blue Collar Intellectuals, When the Enlightened and the Everyman Elevated America. He's the author of previous books, A Conservative History of the American Left and Intellectual Morons. Daniel J. Flynn, welcome.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Thanks for joining us. It seems... You know, I remember sitting with my dad as a kid watching William F. Buckley's Firing Line, which was a pretty intellectual show. And, you know, my dad was a pretty blue-collar guy who worked in a tool and die shop. And it was very popular all across America. And you go back and you read Alexis de Tocqueville, 1836 to 38, and, you know, he was writing about how he would just walk up to farmers in the field and they knew more about European politics than he did. And he was a French intellectual, you know, a 36-year-old young French aristocrat. We have a long history in this country of working people who actually know what the hell's going on. Are you suggesting that they have vanished?
Well, I don't know about vanished, but the book is really about a time when smart looked for you. And I think the difference with today is you can find smart if you look hard enough for it. But 50, 60, 70 years ago, smart looked for you with the Book of the Month Club, with the GI Bill, with the advent of paperback literature, which basically made buying books affordable to all people, with the Carnegie Libraries. All sorts of things were going on in the 20th century to make America the best educated people in the history of the world. And I think if you look around today, there's not a whole lot of evidence that would suggest that we're the best educated people in the world, let alone in the history of it.
Well, the GI Bill, I mean, when the GIs returned from World War II, the United States was at the peak of arguably, probably the numbers were higher back during the Revolutionary era. But, you know, throughout the 19th and 20th century, we were at the peak of higher education with, as I recall, around 6 or 7% of the populace having a college degree. And, you know, within 6 or 8 years of the end of World War II, that number had gone up to nearly 20%, if my recollection is correct, 16, 18%, because of the GI Bill, because the federal government said we're going to invest not only in our physical infrastructure, but in our intellectual infrastructure. And in the process of doing that, Truman and Eisenhower, with those massive investments, took us from a debt of 125% of GDP, which is much, much worse than the debt we have right now, because they got so many people so smart and they put so many people to work and created this infrastructure for America. They paid off the debt by growing the economy. Why don't people get that today? And why are, I get it that, you know, a lot of Democrats are pushing for that, although there are some who aren't. But the Republicans are standing in absolute opposition to anything that would rebuild our intellectual infrastructure. Why?
Well, I think one of the problems is that college has become the new high school. The idea of sending, millions more people into college when, in fact, when you have 14, 15 million people or whatever the number is a year that are attending higher education, it would be great if they could be brought up to the level of higher education. But instead, what's happened is higher education has come down a level. One of the blue-collar intellectuals that I write about, a guy named Ray Bradbury, who your listeners probably know is a science fiction writer, when he was a kid, he had not a lot going for him. He was a nerd's nerd, and he was so poor that he was sleeping in his parents' pull-out couch with his brother well into adulthood. The one thing he had going for him was he was super smart, and when it came time to go to college, he realized he couldn't go. He didn't have the money. So what he did was he went to the public library for 3 days a week, did this for 4 years, and he read and he read and he read. To me, a guy like Bradbury had it right. In other words, he could care less about that piece of paper that comes at the end of the 4 years. All he cared about was the education. I think we have it, as Lincoln would say, bass-ackwards today. All we care about is that diploma, is that piece of paper after 4 years. And the education that comes with it, that's just kind of a perfunctory requirement. And I think that's one of the things that has gone wrong with higher education, is that it's almost like this University of Phoenix model where people are sort of pushed into it and through a diploma mill, and there's the expectation if you give them the money, you get the diploma.
Well, what we're looking at right now is the private for-profit college industry is exploding in the United States, and it's where over 70% of your student loan defaults are happening. These people are graduating from these for-profit colleges with useless educations. Lots of promises were made to them about finding jobs that are not fulfilled. You've got more lawsuits in that area, things like that. Why don't we, when I went to college, and my wife, for that matter, she actually went farther than I did. She graduated. I mean, she put herself through college working as a waitress in Howard Johnson's. That was in the late 60s. My mother worked her way through Michigan State University in the 40s as literally as a lifeguard in Charlevoix, Michigan in the summers. Both had no money whatsoever outside of that. And you could do that back then because we had the land-grant Michigan State was a land-grant college that Abraham Lincoln helped establish to have basically free or very, very cheap education for all the people, just like Thomas Jefferson did with the University of Virginia. But ever since Reagan came into office and ended free college education in California and started and stopped federal aid and just encouraged individual colleges to start being run like businesses, we've seen the decimation of the land-grant college system. It's getting more and more expensive to go to college. Right now, student credit card debt stands at $1 trillion. Student loan debt. It's greater than the national credit card debt. And this is something that we've never seen before in the history of our country. Isn't it time to say enough already with this experiment of laissez-faire capitalism in education and return education to the commons and say, you know, we're going to invest in our intellectual infrastructure the way that we did in the 40s and 50s with the GI Bill?
There's more federal money going to college than in the history of the country. I don't know what...
Well, that's because there's more people than in the history of the country. You got 311 million people in the country right now. There was 200 million people in the country when my dad went to college.
There's, you know, my wife's a college professor at a private institution. It's not even laissez-faire there. The kids are getting so much in federal aid and grants, and I wonder if we could just make the connection a little bit between what, you know, if the federal government subsidizing the tuition and these colleges, private or public, they look at that subsidy as a license, as an invitation to raise tuition, and that's been the trend.
Well, why is that not happening? You know, in virtually there are 34 countries in the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD countries, the 34 richest nations in the world. We are the only one of those nations that doesn't provide free or almost free college to people who graduate from high school. Many of them, for example, Germany and Switzerland, require that you do a year of military service or some other kind of nonprofit service after graduating in high school in order to qualify for that free college. And I think that that's a great idea, that we should have basically a draft here after high school. But none of them are experiencing the kind of inflation that we are outside of their private college systems. So I don't buy your argument.
Well, you know, we're also the destination point for people who want to go to college from around the world. So there is something to be said about, you know, the way higher education operates.
We're the destination point for some. There are many who are going to Oxford or Cambridge or the many good colleges in the UK. There's very good college. People are still going to very good colleges in Paris and in France and Switzerland. I mean, we're not that exceptional.
We certainly are. The fact that we have people from around the world coming to our colleges, it says something about it. But, you know, really what my book is about, what Blue Collar Intellectuals is about, is that education is so important that you can't just leave it up to the colleges or the schools. It is, as one of my Blue Collar Intellectuals, Mortimer Adler, put it, it's a lifetime endeavor. And the reason why it's so important and why this argument transcends politics is because, you know, what Adler said is basically, When you have a kingdom, it's easy. The education fit for a king. You just have to educate that one guy and all is fine. But if you have a citizenry made up of 311 million people, you have to have that education that's fit for a king. That has to be everybody's education. And if you don't have that, you're going to have a citizenry that's not only not fit to govern the country, but not fit to govern themselves either.
I think we're saying the same thing. Probably our ways of achieving it would be different, but people can read about it over at Flynn Files, FLYNNfiles.com. The book is Blue Collar Intellectuals. Daniel Flynn, thanks for dropping by.
Hey, thank you so much.
Yeah, good talking with you today. We'll be back 15 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So how do we educate the next generation of Americans? And speaking of which, what should Occupy be doing next? Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And, in fact, over at TomHartman.com, click on Tom and just scroll down. You'll see some photos from back in the day. Anyhow, Lynn in Los Angeles. Hey, Lynn, what's up?
Yeah, I wanted to talk about the use of violence. Mm-hmm. My parents during the 60s were defense lawyers for the Black Panther Party. Mm-hmm. And when they went to court, they found out that about half their clients were actually people that had become informants for the LAPD.
Had become or had started out that way?
Well, a lot of them had been recruited but had prison records, and then the police came to them and flipped them into becoming provocateurs.
Right.
And my parents were unaware of this, but when they went up for trial, this came out. And so, you know, a lot of people think that by taking a violent route that they are opposing their enemy.
but they're actually becoming this because they're actually working. The police knew that taking a encouraging violence, and a lot of these guys did encourage violence, took away their support from the populace. I mean, the population is in no way going to support violent activity.
No,
it's going to turn everyone against the Occupy movement. And it's our true nature to be loving. If we use love, people will recognize this because this is our innate nature, and this will bring us to a much higher place, and we'll be able to win people over.
Well, and history shows that.
What?
History shows that. You know, whether it was Gandhi or Martin Luther King or Jesus or the suffrage movement or the abolition movement, history shows that. And the group that rose up thinking that they were going to liberate themselves, Robert E. Lee, got his ass kicked. You know, it's like the machine is intrinsically violent, and its violence takes many forms. There's physical violence, there's psychological violence, there's financial violence. The machine is violent. There's no way to deny that. And that's why when you use violence to fight the machine, as it were, to the man, the system, whatever you want to call it, when you use violence to fight that, you are playing on their chessboard. You are using their tools, and they will always win. The one thing that they don't have is nonviolence. That is the tool that the system doesn't have available to it. And
violence is actually the tactic of our opposition.
That's my point.
And we lose our heart and our soul, and then even if we win, we are going to express that same attitude. There's many times when there have been democratic movements where when they turn to violence, then those regimes became repressive in themselves. So we turn ourselves into our opposition.
Yeah.
This will lose our soul, our heart, and we will lose.
Yep, I am absolutely with you. Lynn, thanks so much for the call, and thanks for sharing the story. That's fascinating. Michael in Dublin, Virginia. Hey, Michael, what's up?
Hey, Tom. You know, I'll tell you, I got a blueprint for victory to bring the 99% and the 1% together. So we don't have all of this chanting of no justice, no peace going on in the occupation movement. What I got here is, first of all, the occupation movement that we have has always been a discipline and a model for discipline. So we got to avoid any infighting and all the political dishevelment that causes a delay, not to mention a delay of our victory, not to mention greed and disrespect. They have enemies, too. And we've got to make their enemies our friends. And we don't do that by this political infighting. We've got to change our spending habits, obviously, readjust the tax, roll back those Reagan tax cuts. We have to, and some other things. But let me mention this. Your viewers, if they can go to my website, I have it posted on my website, if I may.
Sure.
Tell you the website. Okay. It's dignity4humanity.com. So that dignity4humanity.com. Okay. I have it posted there, the blueprint for the 99% victory.
Okay, great. Michael, thank you very much. Thanks for the call. Jeff in San Francisco. Hey, Jeff.
Oh, hi. I'm just maybe chiming in a little bit. I'm a teacher out here, and in San Francisco, we have what I guess would be a lot of these anarchist types who I don't think necessarily are paid provocateurs. They just kind of like doing that stuff. I have students who think it's okay to break windows, you know, if it's for the right cause or
right.
corporate thing. So
a variety of tactics.
Regardless of who, whether you're being paid by the police, you're really working for them. I mean, you know, so there's a lot of stuff out here that's just, you know, the police are getting by not even having to pay for it. So. Thank you for your nonviolent stance.
Thank you. Thank you, Jeff, for the call and for the confirmation or affirmation. Martin in Nauwahu, Hawaii. How do you say your city, Martin?
Na'alehu. It means heavenly flower.
Oh, okay. That's beautiful. So what's up?
Yeah. Well, thank you for the opportunity to share an idea which encapsulates the answer to the history and the situations that you've been eloquently describing that the American people have been going through for the past 30 years. I would offer the mechanism of boycotting different products. And lay down a law like China is doing, that is, if you want to sell in our country, half of your production needs to be made here on equipment made here. And that's one of the silent powers that nobody has brought up.
Yes.
See, the nonviolent side is thoughtful and effective, and we need to harness the raw energy that the movement has and direct it towards a goal. And we can lead that as the next step in the Occupy America movement by Occupy America with your pocketbook and with your purchase choices. And we need somebody to get the word out that's put the thought into what would be strategically the best products to boycott first and build upon that as the awareness spreads throughout the country of the reality of Buy America, Build America.
I would, Martin, okay, thank you very much. It's a good suggestion. My concern is that boycotts in and of themselves almost never work. And they also set up a paradigm where, since you're using money, the people with the most dollars have the most votes. I do think, though, that we should be enforcing the Buy America Act that was passed in 1935.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And that law very simply said all federal spending has to be sourced from American manufacturers. And Reagan stopped enforcing it. It's time to bring it back. It's the good, the bad, and the very, very trellaciously ugly. Brought to you by EdisonFactor.com, a supplement for the brain. The good. Mayor Michael Bloomberg. His handling of Occupy Wall Street aside, New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg did some good work this weekend. In an interview with Meet the Press on Sunday, the Republican Bloomberg slammed Congress for not passing stricter gun enforcement legislation. Speaking to David Gregory, Bloomberg said, You'd think that if a congresswoman got shot in the head, that would change Congress's views. Bloomberg has started the group Mayors Against Illegal Guns, which is lobbying for stricter gun enforcement laws. The group even ran an ad during last night's Super Bowl festivities. In an age when federal and state lawmakers are trying to find new and creative ways to arm the nation and get in bed with the NRA, it's nice to see Mayor Bloomberg trying to stop the needless and totally preventable violence that plagues our country. And the bad and the very, very ugly, Fox so-called news. While the rest of the media touted the new jobs numbers released on Friday, Fox News unsurprisingly stayed very quiet, mentioning the new numbers less than half as often as the other major news networks. Then on Fox and Friends this morning, hosts Eric Bolling, Steve Ducey, and Gretchen Carlson suggested that the Bureau of Labor Statistics was cooking the books when it came to the new figures. Bolling stated, "So are they playing around with the numbers? That's the Department of Labor. Hilda Solis heads the Department of Labor. Hilda Solis works directly for President Obama. Getting her two words in, Carlson replied, "I don't think anyone should be surprised that in an election year, it's an interpretation. I think it's the way we describe it." Openly suggesting that the Obama administration is engaged in a propaganda-like campaign? That just doesn't seem very fair and balanced and is very, very ugly. 866-987-THOM, our telephone number. And Peter, in Albany, New York. Hey, Peter, what's on your mind today?
Tom, listen to your program, and I love your ideas, and I want to hear more of you. But I want to tell you, I was a Navy pilot for 6 years, 6 years active duty, got out in 1980, 7 years in the reserves, and Reagan stole my GI Bill in 1982. And one thing you don't talk about is 84% of the Vietnam-era veterans lost their GI Bill under Reagan. So only 16% got it.
I didn't know that. And, when did that happen? How did that happen?
It happened with me because I, as you know, and you've said before, Reagan fired the controllers on August 3rd, 1981, 10,600 of them.
Right.
And I had to fly, to get my airline transport pilot, I had to fly IFR. Okay. That was cut back to 78%. I had to fly within 180 days. And I come up to that, and I flew within the 180 days. They turned around and said it had to be 6 calendar months because it was less, and they threw me out.
Wow. Because
fought it all the way. They said I had a precedent-setting case, but I didn't have the money to fight it.
Oh, geez.
And one other thing, Tom, about boycotts, a poem that got people through the 1930s.
Yeah.
Use it up, wear it out, make it do, or do without.
Yeah. Yeah.
It doesn't say anything about buying anything, and it stopped him in the 30s.
Yeah, and that was the philosophy of my grandparents, who lived through the Great Depression, and Louise's grandmother. That generation is all pretty much gone now, but that's brilliant, Peter. Thank you for calling, and thanks for sharing that. Appreciate it. Rosemary in Boise, Idaho. Hey, Rosemary, what's on your mind today?
Oh, hello, Tom. I was just listening to that last caller. I'm calling today, just wanted to mention about a caller that you had earlier on, a young man who was throwing rocks and breaking some windows because he was reaching out, I feel, in hurt from what the system had done to him. And I wanted to mention that I think the way you responded to him was wonderful. I felt you reached through the screen because he was reacting in a hurt way, because what he's been through has been very painful by what he had to say. Yeah. And I hope he really listened to you and that he can pass this message on, what you said, kind of like the ripple effect.
Yeah.
And pay it on or pass it on to other people that are doing this, because this will be a very detrimental effect on the Occupy Wall Street to have violence get into it.
No, I've been through it, and I know how hard it is to resist. I mean, I was part of a riot that happened in East Lansing in the 60s, and got arrested, and they shaved my head and beat the crap out of me and sprayed me with DDT and humiliate you in every way possible when they put you in jail. And even if it's just for overnight, it's, you know, I know how much, you know, rage you can, particularly as a young person, you know, you can feel against just raw naked authority when it's coming down on you in ways that you think is absolutely wrong. And yet, we have to learn how to transcend that. And it's a challenge, but it's a maturing challenge. It's something that we grow from.
Yes, it is. And, that the message which you gave him, and he obviously is a listener to your show, and knows that you say good things to people and things that have, the best intent. So what you said to him, I hope it resonates.
Hopefully,
and I hope
hopefully it
passes
does.
That on.
Rosemary, thank you so much for your kind words, and thanks for watching in Boise, Idaho. Rick in Humboldt County, California, listening on KGOE. Hey, Rick, what's up?
Hey, Tom, thanks. This is a long time, second time. Bear with me. I've got a cold here. But I wanted to know what you thought of the observation that I've made recently here. You know, as you've said so repeatedly over the last 20 or 30 years, we've moved consistently to the right in this country. And I think one of the big factors involved is the effect of the religious right, more specifically the dominionists, among the religious right, who believe that not only is they've moved, this is a critical tipping point, that is that they not only believe that your political opponent is not just that, he's also your political enemy, which opens the doors for you to do just about anything.
Well, let me take it a step further. They believe that your political opponent is your spiritual enemy. And that's why, and they advance this with things, you know, books and movies about the Antichrist and all this kind of. In fact, there's, you know, I've seen viral emails that are circulating among right wingers suggesting that Obama's the Antichrist. I mean, that's how far it's gone.
And so, do you think that it seems also that the operatives within the Republican Party, that is not only the leadership, but the big money people, a la the Koch brothers, they have sort of co-opted that message and used that to their advantage. And now you see that because of the purity of the dominionist's opinion, it's become acceptable within the Republican Party to take the position that we don't even want to compromise on anything.
To suck
and
up to
so
them.
This is what Obama has been having.
Well, and this
absolute
is
unwillingness to compromise.
Yeah, and this is the power of them. Jeff Charlotte has a new book out on this topic. His last book was The Family, and we interviewed him for his new book a couple months ago. I'm sorry I don't have the title at the tip of my tongue. But it's basically a follow-up on that, on this Dominionist movement. And it's very real. And Jeff Charlotte's writing is, let me commend it to you.
Yeah,
Greg, thanks a lot for pointing that out. Corey in Dunfief, North Dakota. Hey, Corey, what's up?
I was wondering how, my question for you today was, well, it's more of a comment and question, is how is it that politicians and people in political authority get away with things that we normal people like us would never get away with?
Because we have two criminal justice systems in the United States, one for the rich and powerful and one for everybody else.
Wow.
I mean, it's a simple statement of fact, and I challenge anybody to prove that I'm wrong. And in fact, you could argue that we have three criminal justice systems. You've got one for the rich and powerful, which basically lets them skate on anything. You've got one for what's left of the middle class, where, you know, you may or may not get justice, but, you know, there's some reasonableness to it. And then you've got one for the poor and the working poor, where you're just basically screwed. The system's going to eat your lunch.
That's not right.
No, it's not right. And it's a system that's been brought into being. You could argue that it's a vestige of slavery. You could argue that it's a vestige of the Gilded Age, of the royalists of the Gilded Age. You could see Karl Marx argued that it's the absolute normal outcome of capitalism. Without enough regulation. Frankly, I don't see that dual criminal justice system so vividly in countries like Sweden and Denmark and Norway and France and Germany and arguably the United Kingdom, although they do have their own problem with royalty. There's no other way to explain it than just to be blunt and say that that's the truth in America, and it's also the truth in probably the majority of countries in the world.
So I wouldn't be off base to say that it's run by villainous sacks of goat slime.
Well, some of them, you know, there are a lot of people who go into politics or go into powerful positions, you know, go into police work or the judiciary or whatever, because they want the power. And those people are wounded and damaged, and they inflict their wounds. And Corey, thanks for the call. They inflict their wounds and they inflict damage on the rest of us. And then there are people who go in for the most noble of motives. And increasingly, it's becoming more and more difficult for that latter category, for people who have noble motives, for the Bernie Sanders of the world, because their opponents, you know, you've got the billionaires and the big corporations who are more than willing to fund their sellout opponents.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
45 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, back with more of your thoughts and mine right after this. Nine and a half minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. George in Tucson, Arizona. Hey, George, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I love your show. I just want to say I want to thank you for doing all your work, for what you've done.
Not necessary, George. Thank you.
I'd just like to say a few things. I think a lot of people are struck into fear on what to do about this Occupy America. There's no actual leader to follow at all, like Martin Luther King or like Malcolm X, anyone that would like to sacrifice their own lives for this cause. The Occupy Tucson here was shut down, and when that was happening, the police was there and they broke them up, and we even had citizens making fun of them, saying that they were drunks and drug addicts, things like that.
You mean Tucson citizens making fun of the occupiers?
Exactly.
The old dirty hippie thing that they throw at you.
Exactly. Exactly what they threw, when actually some of the occupiers were business owners.
Yeah.
Respectable people that help nonprofit organizations.
Right, and some were dirty hippies, and that's fine too. I was a dirty hippie once, damn it.
That's fine too. It's the purpose of rights. That's what needs to happen.
Yeah.
And there's no actual leader that to actually follow, or a website to go to be on the same page as everyone else in America. everyone's kind of, you know, spread out and is diverse throughout the nation, but they need to be unified somehow. I think a lot of people are quick to go behind the radio or behind the TV show, behind the camera, to criticize on what's going on in America, but not as quick to go to the streets and help out the people themselves.
Right, and that's why I say to people, and that's why, you know, our producer Jacob was down here to Occupy D.C. all weekend, and why I'm saying to people, get out there, show up, participate. I was stuck in my apartment all weekend writing my next book, which is a month behind deadline, but I have shown up. And it, all of us need to, and we need to participate. But is your suggestion that Occupy's weak spot is that it doesn't have leaders?
Yes, actually. Not actual leaders to follow, not good examples like those that have fallen before us. I think it's because of that, to be honest. They're either assassinated or killed.
I would submit to you that leadership is a very, very badly misunderstood term by Americans, that the word leader doesn't appear anywhere in our Constitution. You won't find it in any discussion during the Constitutional Convention or even the Federalist Papers, that from the founding of this country to today, there is, at least among those people who pay attention to how political systems work, there's an understanding that we don't elect leaders, we elect representatives. And were the Occupy movement to begin to elect representatives, and I apparently, and those representatives are totally answerable to the people and can be bounced out by the people at any time, then, you know, that may or may not be a good thing. I'm not going to presume to tell them. But to elect leaders or to appoint leaders or for anyone to stand up and say, I am a leader, makes me as uncomfortable in the Occupy movement as it makes me in the Democratic or Republican Party or the Green Party or, you know, fill in the blanks. The SDS or the Weather Underground, whatever it may be. And so it's, you know, representatives can show leadership, but they only do it when the majority of the people are behind them. It's like the parade gets started and they jump out in front with the flag and say, this is my parade. And now, on the other hand, you know, in Oakland, you had a situation, and we had a conversation with one of the people from Oakland about this last week, where the Oakland, a large number of people in the Oakland Occupy movement marched to occupy a building without having any idea where they were going, because their leadership had decided in secret where the which building they were going to occupy, the theory being that if they decided it in secret, the police wouldn't know. Now, first of all, that's like almost impossible. I mean, the police have the ability to listen in on a conversation from a quarter mile away these days. And the police knew. They were waiting. They were ready. And secondly, what it says is that you've got people who have appointed themselves or been elected, one or the other, as leaders, but they're making decisions in secret, and the people are following those decisions made in secret. And that's where I start getting very uncomfortable, not with the Oakland Occupy movement per se, but with that little tiny piece of it. And I hope that those people in that movement have a good, healthy discussion about that topic. George, thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for bringing it up. I appreciate it. Lois in Seattle. Hey, Lois, what's up?
Well, I was listening to the conversation, and I'm calling in response to the person that was saying there's no leader of the Occupy movement. Mm-hmm. And I know that, and I'm personally glad there isn't a person, because I don't think a person can. But here's what comes to me that is really what is leading it is it's the whole system of principles that we have all learned that are the gist of our country, that make that part of our vision, which hold us together as Americans.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are countless examples of what that is, but
yeah.
Did I say something? Did this make sense?
Certainly, yeah.
Okay.
I think that's brilliant. It's the what holds the Occupy movement together is the ideal of basically a more egalitarian society, a more small-D democratic society. A society
yeah.
that is fair to everybody, a society that isn't rigged with a criminal justice system, one criminal justice system for the very rich and one criminal justice system for everybody else, a society
yeah.
where, you know, Donald Trump, where it's not the case that Donald Trump can declare bankruptcy in Las Vegas one day and you know, own another Trump Tower the next day, you know,
yeah.
whereas if the average person tried to declare bankruptcy, they'd be wiped out and they'd be living out, you know, in the backseat of their car for the next 5 years. I mean, it's
yeah.
just, yeah, I'm absolutely with you, Lois. And it's one of the reasons that I have so much respect for the Occupy movement all around the world. We will be back tomorrow. Told you about a new study recommending that sugar be regulated as a toxin. Well, guess who's all upset about even the idea of that? The conservatives! I'm going to challenge Thomas Lifson, editor of American Thinker, tomorrow. And, of course, we'll pick up these topics and more in the news of the day. And don't forget, democracy begins when you show up. Get out there and occupy something. Occupying the airwaves, Tom Hartman here with you. See you tomorrow. Tag, you're it.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.